Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Guillermo del Toro has put his unique stamp on a wide array of movies, from the serious Pan's Labyrinth to the wildly entertaining Pacific Rim. But he claims that everything he's made so far has led him to his latest film, The Shape of Water.
It is described as a 21st century fairy tale set in the 20th century. The Shape of Water takes place in and out of a 1960s government research facility in the midst of the Cold War. The story follows a mute janitor played by Sally Hawkins as she discovers and forms a deep relationship with an aquatic creature obtained by the government for space research.
Although this is not your typical romance movie, critics far and wide are ranking it among their favorite films of 2017. Our very own contributor Dave Lurson is of the same opinion, and he joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to discuss the film and its director.
There are consistent themes and images throughout his movies. I think without doing him any disservice, you can divide his body of work into two categories, the entertainment category and the art category. Pacific Rim and Blade 2 and Hellboy would be the entertainment. Then he has these much more serious movies like Pan's Labyrinth and The Devil's Backbone and now Shape of Water, which, you can delve very deeply into the meaning of everything practically in every frame of the movie. The use of water, the meaning of eggs, a sense of, constructing a fantasy world. There's a whole lot to see and think about in Shape of Water, as there is in some of his best films. I mean, I think that really the best way to look at Pan's Labyrinth and Shape of Water is to think of it as a 21st century fairy tale. Set in the 20th century, of course, but fairy tales often are set in the past anyway. So it's a fairy tale constructed out of a lot of things, including, images taken from old movies, for that matter.
Yeah, I really like the combination where it has the tension and the intrigue of the Cold War, and yet it combines this with this romanticism of, the late 1950s, early 1960s, of the musicals, of the film industry, kind of turning a blind eye to all of the real-world situations that are happening during this time.
Yes, well, there's a character in the movie who becomes significant, a kind of failed commercial artist who is the only friend of the protagonist, Alyssa, a woman who works as a cleaning lady in this top-secret government facility. I think it's a very telling scene. There's something on TV about the Alabama State Police breaking up the civil rights march at Selma. He turns the channel real quickly to an old musical. At that point in the movie, he doesn't want to deal with the negative reality all around him and wants to turn back and to get a fantasy world of some kind. But he is forced to come to grips with the harsh reality around him through the protagonist, through her growing relationship with the creature, we'll call him, I guess, or the asset, as the government referred to this being, when the government decides that they want to kill him rather than study him.
Even though initially the characters are obviously very set in their daily patterns and this creature kind of turns that around for them, this movie is also a tribute to the outsider in general during a stark time where anyone outside of the white male nuclear family has a lesser standing.
Right. The insider in this movie is a completely evil figure. He's a government agent of some sort or other. He lives in this very nice, tidy little suburban environment. The biggest thing of his life is to buy a new Cadillac. And he's an extremely cruel and hateful person. I mean, you can't really find a particle of light anywhere in his personality at all. The absolute ogre out of a fairy tale. No redeeming value to this character at all. And aside from torturing the creature, he hates the creature for some reason sets the wheels in motion to have him killed instead of, again, studying him or learning what could be learned from this remarkable reptilian amphibian, I think taller than the average human being by a little bit creature. This movie is basically also taken from Creature from the Black Lagoon, a popular 1950s sci-fi movie. And I'm very happy. I think I've spoken about this before. I want to see a return of men in rubber monster suits as a way of expressing these kinds of things in movies rather than bad special effects of other kinds. This is a beautiful monster suit that Del Toro, you know, devised. I would like to get to know this creature just to kind of feel the texture and look at the shifting colors. It's a remarkable achievement, far better than a computer-generated hologram of some kind that we would normally see in films nowadays.
Yeah, and Del Toro even financed that suit himself, you know, either with his own money or his own company's production money. And I think it was absolutely worth it because it adds, you know, I don't think there would have been that palpable connection on screen between him and Sally Hawkins' character.
Well, the eyes of the creature are evident. The eyes are very expressive. Inside that beautiful suit is Doug Jones, not to be confused with the incoming senator from Alabama. This Doug Jones has been a frequent collaborator of Del Toro over the years. It's quite an extraordinary performance, I think. I mean, something that's up there with Boris Karloff, Frankenstein. I mean, as far as expressing something very profound through a cumbersome costume.
Yeah.
It didn't get in the way of emotional expression.
Yeah, this movie at its heart shows the humanity that lies under the fantasy and is a tender and unlikely romance and, you know, shows especially the main character's longing for that connection.
Well, she's a very lonely person. I mean, an orphan. There's a very mythic dimension to all of this. She was an orphan found by the banks of a river. This is a story almost as old as civilization, this type of thing. Again, the water imagery throughout the movie. The creature lives primarily in water, the source of life in the world. So unpacking this, I mean, you can just go on and on forever. I mean, somebody probably will write a book on the subject of this movie, and hopefully not a dry academic, but somebody with a little bit sense of flair and wit, too.
Right. Well, maybe you're the man for the job.
Well, thank you. I'll give it a shot.
Well, and as you mentioned, the prevalence of water and just the settings of this film, it's visually amazing, as most Del Toro things are, but the prevalence of water, you know, he manages to make, say, a rusted government facility or a rundown apartment look romantic.
Yes, there's a real sense of presence in all of that. The government facility is kind of interesting because it looks very much like the sort of things that you know, people imagined government facilities looking like in those days, with the sliding steel doors and the military police and full
big cavernous halls, concrete floors.
Yeah, the scientists in the white lab coats scurrying about. I mean, this is again. So I left there being rather astonished by the whole thing. I mean, it could be my favorite movie of 2017. Not sure yet. There's a few more movies yet to be seen in the last couple of weeks of the year, but it certainly is a contender for that.
Absolutely. And I was surprised at the amount of humor it had, particularly between Eliza and Zelda, played by Sally Hawkins, and, of course, Octavia Spencer. And
right.
It was well-placed. It didn't seem, you know, out of left field.
Not gratuitous at all. I think that, well, fairy tales, I mean, some of the best ones maybe do have an element of humor in them anyway. I think that in terms of doing a movie for a contemporary audience like this, you probably do want to have some comic relief in the film. It would be potentially a very dark movie without that.
Right. And although it's not as unsettling as Pan's Labyrinth was for some viewers, Del Toro still doesn't shy away from the grotesque or violence in this movie.
Well, there are dismembered body parts in one scene. There's a good deal of blood mixed with the water. Again, very primeval imagery there. No, he doesn't shy away from anything at all. Some people may find certain things to be a bit too graphic, but it's not shock value. It's not just trying to, get a rise out of people or whatever the term would be nowadays for this. It fits the story that he's trying to tell.
Absolutely. And I want to talk a little bit more about Sally Hawkins and her character. There's a great quote from the Guardian article that says she imbues a difficult role with longing, courage, and sexuality. Even though she's a mute character and there's some sign language with subtitles in it, she just carries that film, and it just shows you don't need dialogue necessarily to do that.
Well, she's an interesting actor. She's been in a number of we can call them British indie films that have come to Milwaukee over the past 20 years or so, 15 years maybe. She comes out of, like many British actors, out of a stage background with plenty of opportunity to work in high-end British television. So she comes in as an extremely well-trained and emotionally proficient actor. Del Toro probably couldn't have chosen a better person for this part. Also, her appearance. I mean, she has a slightly dowdy look, like a cleaning lady of the 1960s, and yet is a very attractive person. I mean, she just kind of carries this difficult part very well. I would be hard-pressed to think of an American Hollywood actress who could have done it as well as Sally Hawkins did.
Exactly. We also have Richard Jenkins that plays her neighbor, Giles.
Yes, I like Richard Jenkins as Giles. He's another outsider. He's gay. He's an artist. He's having a very difficult time finding work for himself. He lives in this spacious but decrepit setting down the hall from the Sally Hawkins character above an old movie palace. So if you could imagine in Milwaukee terms, apartments above the Oriental Theater.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this would be what, with a fire escape going down to the street level. So he is forced to kind of come out of his armored, kind of protected, yet very vulnerable existence and do something daring. Do something that would put himself very much at risk, because I think that he's been a person who avoided risk his life because the consequences in those days would have been very severe. So he puts himself forward in the attempt to rescue the creature from very evil government handlers.
Another person who puts herself at risk is Octavia Spencer's character, Zelda.
Well, another outsider in those days. African Americans were outsiders almost by definition in circa 1960 Baltimore, too. I mean, Baltimore is still a very troubled city for much the same reason. And the movie, you know, does give a sideways glance at black people who weren't served at the lunch counter of a pie franchise of
right.
all comical kinds of things. She also, you know, has kind of gotten through her life, her character, that is, you know, by being slightly sarcastic, by being kind of Teflon-coated, letting things just flow over her and going about her job. And she is forced to step out of that and be courageous and take a more definitive stand because a life, it's not a human life, it's another outsider life, for that matter, is at stake.
Right, and we already mentioned Doug Jones as the creature, but I know that Del Toro picked these actors specifically, you know, not only because of how they communicate with their acting, their body, but also he stressed that their eyes held a certain characteristic and that these parts were made for these people. And I really can't imagine anyone else taking the roles of any of them.
Well, yes, there's a famous line from Sunset Boulevard where the faded silent actor said, "We had faces then." Well, the characters in Del Toro's movies often have faces. They have eyes. I mean, I think that this is a very good point, that the eyes of the characters communicate a great deal. The eyes are the window to the soul, as Del Toro, I'm sure, would point out, given as he is to, you know, loving primal imagery of that kind. And yes, well chosen, a very well chosen cast. Hard to imagine other people filling those roles.
Obviously, this is not your typical romance that you go and see at the theaters, but, you know, do you suppose that we should tell viewers to keep an open mind and imagination in order to fully appreciate this? You know, you mentioned some scenes and concepts they're not necessarily made to just upset the audience. They're all a vital part of the story. But I suppose perhaps you wouldn't be seeing this if you weren't interested in seeing this fantastical concept.
Well, right. I mean, so there are Del Toro fans who sort of know what to expect. There are probably a general audience. I mean, I think to think of it as a fairy tale and not the kind of Disney fairy tale that many people have grown up on, but the real Brothers Grimm kind of stuff where, you know, savage, brutal things would occur as well as great signs of humanity and initiative for overcoming obstacles. I mean, I think the movie should be seen in that light. And if you think of it that way, You should have an open mind to all that the movie shows.
So it just about fits into your two-hour movie rule. Do you think that there was anything missing from this film or,
no.
You know, any complaints at all?
A perfectly paced movie for a change. I mean, there are some movies this year and the past few years that I've enjoyed, but they just, the rhythm is off. There's no rhythm to it. I mean, it's if the director was a musician, their music would be terrible because there's no beat. I mean, Del Toro has a rhythm. I mean, he understands how to make a movie move forward at just the right kind of tempo.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express newspaper and a regular Lake Effect contributor. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the film, The Shape of Water.